I had another patient who lost her entire group of friends, was not supported by the school.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guests today are the co-founders and directors of Gesher Campus Care, a nonprofit connecting the Jewish community to safe, supportive, and culturally competent therapists. We'll unravel all of that. And here I am with Jessica Zmud and Shelley Steinwurzel. Did I say that correctly?
You're great. You got it.
I think the theme of this season is names I cannot pronounce. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us. We are incredibly honored.
I am just, you know, we've been talking for 10 minutes before we even started, and you're radiating, so it's nice. Shelley and Jessica, I'm going to start with the question that I start every episode, and I'm going to start with Shelley. So Jessica, you get a moment to think as well. Shelley, what kind of a Jew are you?
I think of myself as a miraculous Jew.
A miraculous Jew?
Yes.
I have never heard that answer, okay?
Yes. And it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with my grandparents. All four were Auschwitz survivors. And the fact that I exist is a miracle because any moment they could have not existed. And then all of us in their lines wouldn't be here. So despite all the odds, here I am.
How many people are in the line?
Well, so I grew up in an extended family of Soviet Jewish immigrants here in America. And so I didn't realize that we were all miracles, but all of us had, all of our grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust and then had to stay in Russia after the war. They were locked in until the 70s. And my mom was on one of the first flights out of the Soviet Union to America. But so now in my family, I have two daughters. My brother has three daughters. My cousins each have two kids. So it's a bunch of us. And then the extended family is much larger and it's really beautiful.
Wow. Jessica, what about you? What kind of a Jew are you?
Wow, maybe a few kinds of Jew. I would say awake, defiant, incredibly proud, incredibly sad, and grateful. It's a lot of things.
And a lot of emotions, which I think is very relevant to what we'll talk mm-hmm. about. But I do want to ask you, because I've noticed a lot of people have been using the word awake. Mm. Which is very interesting because it's in opposition in a way to woke, mm-hmm. right? What does awake mean for you? And you know, and how do you differentiate that from a woke Jew?
Yes, I mean, awake is sort of, I think I saw it happening before October 7th. I saw it in the Women's March on Washington. I saw it when I went with my daughter to a Black Lives Matter march where she had a Tikkun Olam, means Black Lives Matter, sign, and people were not looking at us in a friendly way. And at the end of the march, there was a speaker series about colonialism and apartheid and racism, and Israel was brought up, and I thought, we don't belong here. And so this is the woke movement, and we are excluded from it. I think obviously now things have multiplied a millionfold. And after October 7th, I think that was incredibly traumatic. But October 8th and every day after has been just beyond what we ever could have imagined. And I think I have sort of seen the Matrix since October 8th, and I feel awake to that. I see sort of like all of the pieces that have been in motion for the last 20 years, now kind of the machine activated on October 8th. And I'm sort of like, why does every Jew not see this? Why is every Jew not awake like this? Please wake up. And that is what makes me a sad Jew now. It's what makes me awake and makes me sad. And the defiant is that it is so scary, but I am not going to shrink from it. I am going to lean into my Judaism. I'm going to lean into my love of Israel. I'm going to lean into defending our people from anti-Semitism. And yeah, that's where I'm at.
And you're both therapists. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about all that you've been doing since October 7, 2023. But take me as much as you can into your therapy sessions before October 7. How much was being Jewish, being Israeli or pro-Israeli, being Zionist, how much did that play a role in sessions at all? From your perspective, from clients' perspective?
Not at all. I mean, I think my clients probably knew I was Jewish because I would take those days off. You know, they probably could figure it out pretty easily. But it was really not a huge part of my practice. In the hospital, in the NICU, I probably would talk about it maybe a little bit more.
I should say that you were a therapist at Columbia NICU, right?
Yeah, so I was the staff psychologist in the NICU at Columbia University Medical Center for almost a decade. And then more recently, I was exclusively in my private practice. And so in the hospital, it would come up from time to time, especially when there was an Orthodox family from Brooklyn. They would say, Steinwurzel, are you related to Rabbi Steinwurzel? And I would say, no, but, you know. But in my private practice, it really wouldn't come up very often, maybe only if a patient would bring it into the session. I also work in Westchester County. I have a fairly progressive clientele for the most part. And so it wasn't, and they were, you know, some Jews, not Jews. It didn't, you know, it was a mix. And so it didn't come up. It wasn't an issue. Yeah. It was, nobody was coming in hatefully against my Judaism, but it also was sort of, you know, not really a big part of anybody's conversation.
How about you, Jessica? You know, for you, it was a bit more, I understand.
Yes. But still. So I think the patients that came to me from Orthodox communities and had come out as queer in some way, it was very important to them that I was both Jewish, understood Orthodoxy and what it means to leave the fold or be ostracized from the fold, and also that I am accepting of their identity and like the dual identity. So that has been part of my practice for quite a long time. I also grew up Reform until I was 14, and then my parents became modern Orthodox. So I really do have a foot in both worlds, and I live in a modern Orthodox community, but I kind of do my own thing. So I feel like...
Very defiant.
Yes. So I feel like for them, it was helpful and safe to know that I'm straddling these two worlds too. And I don't believe in the sort of, I don't even think there is a blank screen model of psychotherapy anymore where your patients can know nothing about you. We don't live in that world anymore. So if it's useful for the therapy and productive, I will share something about my identity. It did not come up in any ways that made me feel uncomfortable until October 7th.
Right. So I mean, what I'm hearing is, for you, Shelley, it rarely came up only if, you know, it was pertinent to the issues discussed. For you, Jessica, it came up, but more in the internal Jewish world, but mm-hmm. nothing or almost nothing about feeling persecuted, anti-Semitism, the Jewish identity in the non-Jewish world.
Yes, absolutely.
So then what happens? What happened after October 7th, Shelley?
Well, I was actually, on October 7th, I was on a girls' trip with my grad school friends. I was the only Jew in the middle of Georgia where we were hanging out in the woods. And my phone started to go crazy. And I looked at it and I went outside because it was very early in the morning when I started getting the notifications. And I just started to cry hysterically. I couldn't catch my breath. I was hyperventilating. And I called my husband and woke him up and said, do you have any idea? Is this for real? I can't, you know, understand this. And it was really interesting because then my friends started to hear me crying because I guess it must have been very loud. And they came out and they were like, what's wrong? And I couldn't speak. And I told them about it, about what was happening. And they were wonderful and validating and helpful in that moment, but I don't think they fully grasped why a Jew in America would be hysterical in that moment, why I couldn't catch my breath, why I felt like my brothers and sisters and parents and grandparents were attacked in that moment, even though I didn't know anybody in those kibbutzim or at the festival.
Can you grasp?
Why? Yeah. It's in my soul. We're all connected. I don't know how else. I've always had this. I remember the first time I went to Israel and I stood, we were at like one of the excavation points by the wall, and I was like, I felt more whole in that moment than in any other moment prior. We're all one. I don't know how else. I feel it deeply. I've always felt it. I don't know. I'm a very spiritual person. I always have been. I think all humans are connected in a deep way, but we're a tribe. And I felt it more that morning than ever before. And it was interesting because, I don't know if that answers your question, I can't explain it. I think it's just because we are actually, I started looking into the genetic connection. I was like, how are we all connected? Are we really connected? How does it work? We all have the same sort of markers in our DNA. Any Jew that is, I mean, obviously there are converted Jews and half, whatever you want to, but any Jew that has any like lineage, we share DNA markers. We are actually connected, right? Which I find fascinating that we have, I mean, talk about Jewish continuity. Like we have maintained this connection across the corners of the earth.
But I do want to note, yes, because there's something interesting, right? Like your friends in that trip couldn't understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult to understand. It's almost an unfair request that we put on people.
Totally.
To understand something that is so deep.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I do think it's unfair. I think the fair mm-hmm. thing is to ask them to be curious about it,
yeah,
and not mm-hmm. judgmental. That's completely fair. It's unfair to expect them to understand it off the bat. But if they completely negate it off the bat, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't expect them to understand. I appreciated, in fact, that they were curious. The one person who did understand, and I find this, and it still touches me deeply, she and I look like we could be sisters. And we went to grad school together. She was born in Germany and moved here when she was like 6 or 7 years old. And she understood. She said, wow, like, this is horrifying. I grew up learning about what the Germans did, what we did, and how we had to own it, right? And that this must be such a re-traumatization for all the Jews who are witnessing this. And so she got it mm-hmm. in a different way. And I was so grateful for her. And we sat and we hugged and cried together. And it doesn't answer your question about after. I was a mess after October 7th. And when I started seeing colleagues and friends posting about resistance is justified, when my mayor wouldn't, you know, send out a message to the Jews in town and to the town collectively about this terrorist act because they were freedom fighters. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. It hit on a whole new level that I woke up real fast. And was also one of those people who fought for every social justice issue because I believe deeply in our collective humanity. And to be betrayed so quickly in the aftermath, fortunately for me, most of my patients in the immediate aftermath either said nothing or were horrified. And we could sit together in shared grief. But when I started to see what was coming out and the backlash on in different spaces, I was very fortunate that it wasn't in my space directly.
So Jessica, I'll ask yes. you, because some people might be listening or watching and say, unclear what came out. What is this, these things that came out in the aftermath?
So it's interesting. On October 7th, I got a call very early. I woke up and said, is your daughter okay? There's a war in Israel. My daughter was on a gap year and she was right near Lebanon for Simchat Torah. And when they said war in Israel, I was like, what does that mean? And then I figured it out very quickly. I was scared. I was horrified. But what was really interesting, and I think this connects kind of to the college campus situation, my daughter and all of her friends who were on their gap year there, as the year progressed, they all started feeling much more scared and unsafe about seeing what was happening on the college campuses and were feeling much more safe in Israel and nervous about going to college the following year. And in fact, many did not. Many dropped out of their colleges, including Columbia, and enrolled in IDC or Bar Ilan, and that's where they are. So I think that was very telling. In terms of me, I think I had this feeling of responsibility right away. I was not on social media much, and all of a sudden I became very active on Instagram, very active on Facebook, and I'm, you know...
Why?
Because I was seeing the lies and the propaganda and the anti-Semitism almost immediately. And I thought, okay, I may be screaming back into a void, but if one person hears, whoever's out there needs to hear that there's not one narrative, that there is another side, and we were attacked and we deserve to get our hostages back. We should, any other country would. And it would be normalized. And also, we are trying to dismantle a terrorist entity, also something that would be acceptable by any other Western standards. And so I saw the gaslighting. I saw the moral inversion. I saw the moral, you know, equity right away. And I just thought, you know, that line, you know, was it Rabbi Tarfon that said, you know, it is not my responsibility to complete a task, but it is my responsibility to engage. You can't turn away. And I just felt like this is what I have to do. And I think my parents also were very active in Jewish social justice causes growing up. We like sponsored a family from Russia to get to America. And so that impacted me a lot. And I'm really also, I'm doing this for my kids. I want them to be proud of who they are, who Israel is, and I want them to see that when the world is turning against you, you don't have to cower, you don't have to hide. Don't internalize this anti-Semitism. You know who you are. Be proud of who you are. Stand strong in who you are. And they're all different. They don't. That's not how they are. But I
that's
thought
that's what you aspire them to be.
Yes. And my daughter is an artist, and she does her own thing. Like, she expresses herself very differently. Like, she took tape, the tape that Rachel Pollan wore, of course, every day while the hostages were taken, and she cut up tape, each piece of masking tape, very tiny, and made a portrait of her face for her out of the masking tape, and like dropped it at her house. And that was her way of supporting and connecting. And she's doing similar things through her art at college. And so I'm sure I just roundabout didn't even answer the question, but also my patients, I have a different practice than Shelley. And my practice did change after October 7th. I had one patient who joined an encampment, and so we talked about that in the therapy session. Very hard for me, very painful. But it's her therapy, it's her goals, it's her experience, and I am there to help support her goals. So it was really my job outside of the session to process it and work through whatever feelings came up. But it definitely takes an emotional toll. But then I had another patient who just developed this really special relationship with, who experienced horrible anti-Semitism on her campus. She's Israeli-American, lost her entire group of friends, and had no one, and was not supported by the school. She had a situation where everybody in her class found out what her heritage was. They all wore keffiyehs and sat on one side of the classroom and left her alone on the other side of the classroom, and nothing was done by the teacher. This girl is the most resilient girl I have ever seen. And she had she came in already with all the coping skills anyone could want, but was really having a hard time naming and figuring out the trauma that was happening to her. And, you know, I think we discovered that there was just so much grief there, just grief at the betrayal, grief at the loss, moral confusion. She tried to talk to these friends who she had known for many, many years and build bridges, and none of them wanted to build bridges with her. And it came to a point where she said to one of them, "I feel like when you look at me now, you don't even see me for me and the person you've been best friends with for 4 years. I feel like you just look at me and see the war, and see everything you hate in Israel's politics." And the friend just looked at her and didn't respond. And she was like, "Okay, I'm dehumanized. That's where it is." And so she and I have done so much work and going in two steps forward, one step back, because it's active trauma. The trauma keeps getting re-triggered because one thing after another keeps happening. You recover from this, and then this happens. And I think we're all just trying to get to a place where we can almost get to the post-trauma. Like, right, can this end so we can start processing it and moving through it? It's very hard to do that when it's all still happening.
Wow, there's so much to talk about there. I have so many thoughts, but I want to ask you, because you are the first therapist that I've had here on the show. And, you know, we've focused so much on the physical trauma and the physical fight against anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, anti-American bias on campuses, and in general. But what's going on in the therapy world? Like, it seems to me like the therapy world should not be affected by this. And I know it's very, very naive of me, but my experiences in an understanding of the therapy world in general is you show up in a room, it's a nondescript room, there's a noise machine, you know, outside, so no one other than you and the therapist can hear what's going on. It's completely accepting. Why is it an issue all of a sudden?
Great question. Your perception of what therapy ought to feel like is my perception of what therapy ought to feel
and
like.
Mine. That's,
yes.
That's,
I mean, that's
that
a driving force.
That is how we
force.
Were trained. Yes.
Yes, that's 100% how we were trained. And the reason we became so concerned was there's this new-ish theory of decolonizing therapy and how to politicize your space. And it there are many elements to it, but it's...
Wait, can you break that? Because you take that for granted. What does that mean to decolonize therapy and to, you said, politicize your space?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So the idea, and Jess, you jump in whenever you want, but I mean, the idea is effectively that the mental health system, the diagnostic system is all part of a colonial project. And it's created by the oppressors to maintain oppression over the marginalized communities.
Therapy itself.
That the idea is that your anxiety is actually related to your Zionism or your misogyny or being a victim of somebody else's oppression. And some of this, you know, Freud talked about some elements of this, that the hysteria.
Freud is a famously oppressor, you know, yes. Jewish oppressor in Vienna.
Yes.
To flee his Vienna because he was so oppressive.
He was very oppressive, but he was white, right?
By the way, a joke also is that this movement is also trying to dissociate Freud from being the father of psychoanalysis and the inventor of psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. So like you see this erasure of Jews from every space, and it's happening even in this space too.
Actively and vociferously. I mean, there are... So this is part of what the decolonizing therapy, it's not just against Jews, it's against all oppressors, because Jews, of course, are the worst oppressors, as we, you know, anti-Semitism is this shape-shifting virus. And so in the psychotherapy world, we have been sort of placed in this category. And it is very categorizing. It's very black and white. There are rules to follow. At least that's how I experience it and read it. And so a lot of what, let's say, you were seeing on the Columbia campus is paralleled in the psychotherapy space because they have the same origins. It's the idea that rage, that resistance is justified, right? Right after October 7th, we all saw those resist colonial power by any means necessary. They were plastered all over my town. And it's this idea that if you oppress a group hard enough, they will resist and they will do it by any means necessary, even if it is the most barbaric thing you've ever witnessed. And I actually don't think that's true or accurate. And I don't think that we should be excusing that kind of behavior, but it's effectively saying that you can have what we call anger management in the therapies, in the psychotherapy world or psychology world, is an inaccurate, you know, terminology, because if those people have been oppressed enough, then their rage is not an anger management problem, but it's a systemic problem, and they are warranted in behaving that way.
But you know, one thing that is striking to me is I completely disagree with that view, you know, of the general oppressor oppressed, but also of decolonizing therapy? Like, it feels like no one is, who are the colonizers in therapy? But even if we accept that, which I don't, that's talking about groups.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end, therapy is one therapist, one client, or maybe two if it's a couple, mm-hmm. or a parent and a child. And it has nothing to do with the groups. So how does the decolonization yeah. framework affect practice?
So I go to see you for therapy, and I am a Zionist Jew, and I am coming in with depression or anxiety. So the lens is that my job as a therapist, as a decolonizing therapist, is to help you understand that your oppressive, colonizing, racist mindset that you were bred with, that's part of Zionism, is what is contributing or causing your anxiety or your depression now, because we're in a place right now where your power is being toppled and you're having a hard time managing that, and it's manifesting in these ways. So the treatment is to help you understand how you've been an oppressor, how you have kept other people down with your identity, and to deconstruct that part of your identity, so that you can learn how to be an anti-racist. And once you accept all of that about yourself and work through that, then you'll start to feel better.
So if I understand this correctly, because there's a lot here, but if I go into therapy and I say, I'm having a hard time sleeping at night because of the images I saw during the October 7 massacre, and I keep thinking about Kfir and Ariel Bibas, or I keep thinking about the female hostages, or I keep thinking about, you know, any of the things, instead of the therapist, or maybe in addition, I don't know, of saying, I'm sorry for you and let's grapple with that, there's also a reframing saying what you're really reacting to is not the carnage that you experience, but what that carnage symbolizes, which is you are no longer the top dog. You're no longer the ruler. And you're basically paying the price, even if you didn't oppress, like, of your oppressing brothers and sisters or history.
Yep.
I mean, I think that it probably shows up in lots of ways, but examples that we've heard from patients who saw another therapist prior to finding a safe therapist, they'll say, I went to this therapist, I told them what I was experiencing and with my peers or the trauma I was envisioning of what happened that day. And they said, well, you can try and see it from their perspective of why they might not want to be friends with you if you won't denounce Israel, or why do you think the Gazans did this? If, you know, were they being oppressed?
Which, by the way, I think in therapy comes a lot, like, look at it from different perspective, right? That's part of the mm-hmm. idea of talk therapy of, none of us see all reality, mm-hmm. By ourselves, and we need to have those conversations. But the problem becomes not so much when you're asked or prompted or forced to take another perspective, but only when specific groups, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. I imagine if an African-American client comes and talks about fear of police brutality, they're never asked to take the perspective of, a white or black officer who's been overworked and scared and all that stuff, right? I don't know if they should be asked, right? Mm-hmm. If someone who, has been a victim of an hate crime because of their sexual orientation, mm-hmm. they're never asked to say, well, think about what the other side feels when they are, mm-hmm. but yeah. then for some reason, when it's Jewish clients, Zionist clients coming and saying, here's my trauma, mm-hmm. then there's that extra layer.
Yeah. I mean, and it takes away all of the safety and all of the validation, which is the cornerstone of like how therapy starts working. You must feel safe in the session. You must feel validated. You must feel seen, heard, understood by your therapist. And right there, that dislodges all of that.
Where did this come from? Like, or when? We're about the same age, or I think you're a couple of years older than me, but it doesn't seem like it used to be the case in therapy 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, or, you know, you went to school probably 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I would say not even 10 years ago.
It's pretty new.
I think that October 7th just allowed these things that have been brewing for so many years that I think we underestimated in a significant way. It all exploded after October 7th. And I think, like, even when we're looking at the college campuses now, so much of the things that were shocking and brought horror to us that we were watching, I think, have now sort of diffused to become normalized outside of campus. So that all of that stuff on campus is not so shocking anymore, because we're seeing it in the streets of New York. We're seeing it
in the mayoral race in New York.
100%. That it is normal for people who are not Jewish to redefine what anti-Semitism is, to redefine what Zionism is, to redefine what IRA is, and to invert those definitions and to use them to hurt us and to use them to promote anti-Semitism. So I think, like, everything we're talking about is diffuse across so many different areas. And you know, I think there's been this question of, now that the hostages are back and now that there's
hostages.
Yes, of course. And that there's a ceasefire, whether temporary or not, is anti-Semitism going to get better? And from what I'm seeing, it's not looking like that right now. It almost looks like just a normalization.
So we've outlined the problem, or at least we've touched the surface, scraped the surface of the problem. Now you've offered one solution. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Gesher Campus Care. How did it come about, and what is it?
Came about in a car ride that Shelly and I were in.
Do you remember where you were going?
Yeah, we were, Shelly and I met actually on a WhatsApp group trying to overthrow an anti-Semitic congressman, which we were successful at, which is great. And I was just seeing what she was saying on the chat, and I was like, I like this girl. She's got a lot of good stuff to say. Also, the name Steinwurzel, as you know, very unique. And I was like, I went to college with a Steinwurzel. This is definitely Shelley's husband, and it is.
I was gonna put my bet on Rabbi Steinwurzel. Okay.
But yeah, so I got it right. It was the right Steinwurzel. Yes. And Shelley said, you know, I'm going to this event for Natal, a panel, which is, Natal is an Israeli trauma treatment center. And she said, you want to come along with me? So we met for the first time, and we had dinner after, and we both said, listen, we're in so much pain for our people. We want to help our people. Whatever we're doing in our private practices is not cutting it. Like, we need to do more. And where can we be of service? And we talked about, I went to the IAC conference. She had been in ADL, and we were going to all these panels, seeing who is being supported, where are they being supported, and where are people not being supported. And all of the students seem to have a lot of legal support at that point, and a lot of advocacy support behind them. But I asked them, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Who's helping you emotionally? Because this is a lot for you to carry. You're a kid. You're right out of your parents' home and you know, from the frying pan into the fire. And it's like, so they were like, oh, nothing. We're just leaning on each other. And so Shelley and I were like, okay, that's it. We got to get them help. And also, therapy is so expensive now if you're not in an insurance network. So we were like, okay, how do we make it accessible? We've got to get them subsidies so they can afford it. And then there was this other piece, which was the decolonizing therapy. And in fact, Jewish therapists, some are part of this. So we said, okay, we have to create a closed network to make sure our therapists are not doxxed, of safe Jewish therapists, not even Jewish therapists. You could be not Jewish, you could be an ally, anyone who is safe for a Jewish person to come in and be their whole self and know that they are accepted by their therapist. They won't be judged and there's no agenda but to help you. And again, that was kind of a response to this whole decolonizing therapy movement. And then we said, okay, well, what do we need to do to ensure that for the patients? And at that point, we were really focused on student, faculty, and staff on college campuses. And I guess Shelley can tell you like how, what we've done to try to make it safe.
Yeah. Tell me, yes. Not just how you try to make it safe, but what is your definition of safe?
Right.
I mean, it's clear to me, like if someone shows up with a keffiyeh or a pin with a map of Palestine, you know, they might feel unsafe for a client, just like if they show up with any other strongly political messaging, you know, which I wouldn't want any of my therapists. But beyond that, what does it mean to be a safe therapist for Jewish clients these times?
So for us, we have our own definition.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do in each of our introductory trainings with our therapists is to say, we want to depoliticize the space. So, you know, we are here to help you work through any countertransference you might have when somebody comes in. So countertransference is, so when a patient comes in and they are, you know, acting something out with you, or they are bringing something into the treatment space, it brings up feelings in us. Sometimes it's directly related to the patient, like it's being either put into us from the patient, by the patient, in unconsciously. Sometimes it's that they're lashing out whatever they're feeling, and then we feel it. So that's, countertransference is really a tool for us to understand what our patients are feeling. That's the best use of what you're experiencing that's being put into you in the psychic space of the therapy frame. Then there's also just like you're a person in the room as a therapist. And if your patient comes in wrapped in keffiyehs and, you know, bloody hand pins, you're going to have your own experience and your own reactions. That, how do you monitor that so that when your patient would come in, you would be able to say, I'm here, you know, this is what she's working out. This is what we're figuring out. And our philosophy is, we hold space for our patients no matter where we are. I can have lots of feelings against sex offenders, but if that's my practice, I have to be able to hold that is a problem. But if they're here with me, I can't just knock them down and say, that's a horrible thing to do. You're a terrible person. You sit with them. You figure out why they're feeling, what are they feeling about this? What are they feeling when they're in the encampment? Why did they decide to wear the keffiyeh if that's what they're coming in with, right? And what does it mean to be a safe therapist? So for us, we have all of our therapists sign off on the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism because we find that to be a widely accepted, adapted definition.
Let me just, for our listeners, mm-hmm. the IHRA definition is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition. It's multiple countries in the UN came with it together. It's been adopted by most Western countries, by most major cities, not by Columbia, yes. But by some universities. Mm-hmm. And it basically says that when you attack a Jewish collective, if it's synagogue, if it's a community, or if it's Israel as the embodiment of a Jewish collective, then that is a part of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Not that you can't be critical mm-hmm. of Jewish collectives or of the state of Israel and its actions, but when you say it shouldn't exist, when you really go after its core, mm-hmm. you are edging on, anti-Semitism.
Right. So the fact that the UN has more resolutions against Israel than any other country.
All other countries combined.
Combined. So to me, that it's not that you can't criticize Israel. It's just when you criticize Israel above and beyond what you're doing with any other nation, that's anti-Semitism. And so the criticism, it's the double standards, it's, it's a Holocaust inversion, which we're seeing all of this everywhere. When you, Shai, as a Jew on campus, is being held responsible for the actions of all other Jews and the state of Israel, that's anti-Semitism. Right. So, I mean, that's what the IRA definition.
So every therapist that goes through your network goes through some introduction seminar.
Yeah. So they
sign off the IRA.
They
definition.
Sign off on the definition. They do an introductory training, which teaches about what is anti-Semitism, what does it look like, what are the different psychological components that are coming into play, what is the trauma associated with anti-Semitism. And how can we as therapists help our patients who are coming in with those traumas? And how do we help ourselves through that process? And so it's just this baseline training. We also offer additional trainings, but they're not mandatory like the introductory one is.
So how many therapists do you have in your network so far?
We have, I think signed up and not fully trained. We have about 250 and we've trained about like under 200. So we have to get another
right
training
around
going.
200. Yeah.
Yes. And I think sort of dovetailing on what Shelley said, the training that we do, because this is so important, one, for emerging adults that are in that space of like their identity is not yet stabilized. So what happens when you go out into the world for the first time? And some people have more stable sense of identity, some people have less. And then what happens when you go into a space and people invalidate you, people shame you, people guilt you, people shout you down? What does that do to your sense of self? And so I think even for that specific population, it's really important for people to understand the impacts on identity and also impacts on mental health in this population. We have a colleague, Mary Bar-Halpern, who does a lot of work on traumatic invalidation in the Jewish community. And what has that looked like to be, again, like blamed for what's happening in Israel as an individual? And I mean, there are a million other factors.
But can you kind of mentioned that very quickly, but traumatic invalidation, mm-hmm. the in is the new part. What is traumatic invalidation and why is it so difficult for people?
So it's a term that it was initially coined by Marsha Linehan from Dialectical Behavioral Therapy, but this person is really working on how that term has become very specific to anti-Semitism for Jews in the last couple of years, because there is a minimizing of the pain that they're going through, a denying of it, just a complete, like, it's not valid, it's not happening, a shaming and a guilting for having that pain. And all of that, like, when you have an event like October 7th, and then on October 8th, you have your community validating and supporting you and sitting with your pain and asking, how they can be helpful, that minimizes the possibility of trauma. you know, that minimizes your risk factors for developing PTSD. But when the opposite happens, then we're going in another direction. We are more susceptible to anxiety disorders. We're more susceptible to depression, more susceptible to PTSD. And that's what we've been seeing. And I think it's been so challenging because there wasn't a name for it for so long of like, what's happening to me? What is this experience? And it's been really nice that like she's been able to put a name to it. And
a lot of therapy is mm-hmm. naming the mm-hmm. problem helps you deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had more to say on that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the traumatic invalidation piece is really, you know, people talked a lot about feeling betrayed by...
Both of you talked about feeling betrayed.
Yeah, I felt very betrayed by the community, the lay community, but then the psychological community, the mental health community. When you start seeing people who you thought of as like sisters and then who you worked with for years, and then they're justifying the most horrific things that you've ever imagined, it's a real betrayal. And I personally felt very betrayed by the field, because mental health practitioners are taught to help people live in the gray, not live in the black and white, right? There's that, how do we live in the nuance and understand, you know, empathy within the intellect, right? It's both, not just one or the other, right? Another idea is this empathicide that we've trained, that for generations we've been training people to be so empathic, but it's come to the point, this was another psychiatrist's term, that it came to a point of so empathic that they can empathize with people who want to kill them. And that it's this idea
suicidal empathy.
Mm-hmm. But the traumatic invalidation, I mean, I think of, you know, I'm a big fan of yours. I will just put it out there. between like all of the WhatsApp, you know, Columbia WhatsApp chats and Instagram, and you were out there every day fighting the fight. And one of the things that I saw, I don't know if it's what you felt, but one of the things I saw you fighting for on behalf of people who were more afraid to do so was the betrayal and the invalidation that you seem to be experiencing from the administration, from your colleagues who weren't going, not the Jewish colleagues necessarily, just your other colleagues who were like, you're Israeli, you're the bad guy, this is free speech, right? And that there were no commitments by the grownups in the room to say there's a time and a place and a manner for this. And instead, the whole university was taken over. And I think that the invalidation, it was a trauma we were all experiencing. There was a collective trauma. There were individual traumas. There was historical trauma being revitalized and re-triggered. Intergenerational traumas were being re-triggered, certainly for me. I mean, I was like, there's no way in hell I am walking into the you know, like a sheep to the slaughter. I mean, my best friend knows, I'm like, she's like, why are you fighting so hard? Like, you're not going to, there's a drop in the bucket. I'm like, I'm not going to be a sheep to the slaughter. Like, there is no way. I mean, and, you know, you have a whole prepper chat. Like, there's a lot going on. But, you know, we were all reacting to that in different ways, in our own ways, traumatic invalidation.
It's funny, you know, people have asked me why I reacted so strongly to everything that was happening on campus. And the best answer I could give him is I didn't grow up here. I am not product of the system. So I don't have the cognitive defense mechanisms. It was like throwing someone without an immune system into a preschool. I was just shocked. I've never, you know, the one good thing about, there's many good things about living in Israel, but one good thing that differentiates Israel from everywhere else in the world, there's no anti-Semitism.
Right.
There's hatred, there's anger, you're targeted as an Israeli, but you don't walk around with anti-Semites around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I was surrounded by Jew hatred, and it was like I was at capacity.
Yeah.
So what do you do when you're at capacity? You either fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm. Or fawn.
Or I couldn't flee. Many people froze around me, so I didn't want to fight. I wanted to freeze as well, but everyone else froze, or many people froze.
No, which, by the way, I thought you, when I saw your video on the quad, I thought you would be number one. I said, okay, this is professor number one that's standing up, and in the coming days and months, we're going to see professors from all over the country.
I mean, that was my hope. That was the goal.
And then it was just you.
So I do want to go to that, because we've talked a lot about the students and we talked about the therapists, but you also provide healthcare for mental health care for faculty and staff. What are some of the issues that Jewish faculty and staff have been experiencing on campuses?
So that's a great question. And that was actually a surprise for Shelly and I. We did not think we were going to hear from faculty as much. What we've learned is that the Jewish faculty and even administration that were sympathetic and safe places for the Jewish students to go to share what was happening, the students will learn who they are, and then they go to them to sort of confide and almost even for therapy, you know, informally, because they don't have a safe space to go. So these faculty members or administrators are carrying all of the pain of the students and all of their trauma, and really it's having a significant psychological impact on them, and it's a vicarious trauma. So they need support for that. And then this other piece, I mean, there are many pieces, some that are on tenure track and know that the boards who are voting for their tenure are anti-Semitic, certainly anti-Zionist. They have to keep quiet and stay in the closet about their identity so that they don't get discriminated against and lose their tenure that they've been working for, you know, whatever, 10, 20 years for. And that, you know, again, we talk about the invalidation, that is so, so hard and so sad. And they're sitting with all of that. The punishment.
Mm-hmm. So interesting, the word you said, stay in the closet. I have noticed that, of course, we focus on the anecdotal, like the Queers for Palestine and all of that. But I've noticed that many of our biggest allies have been non-Jewish gay men. You got Douglas Mary, Daniel Ryan Spalding, Luai Ahmed. Like, because it's, you know, despite the different contexts, despite the different stories, it's the same psychology.
Mm.
You cannot bring your entire self into the world out of fear of marginalization, out of fear of economic concerns, losing your job, losing your respect, whatever it is. Do you notice similarities there? Am I just like shooting in the dark?
Yeah.
For sure. Go ahead. You take it, Shelly.
No. It was a term that one of the clients who came to us was working as a staff member and was the only Jewish campus staff member who created a safe space for this particular university. And she used this term of all of a sudden, after the encampment popped up overnight, it was like all these Jewish people, kids on campus were in the closet and just like couldn't stay in there anymore. And they had to come out because it was just so scary to be alone. And, you know, and she held all of it. I mean, ended up needing to leave because there was so little support at that particular university. But it was a striking term. It still gives me goosebumps because it is this parallel of you can't be you. We have worked so hard to allow space for people to be their whole selves, particularly in the queer and gay community, but in all communities, right? Like, I guess it's in the communities where you can hide, right? So in the gay community, a lot of the times you can sort of hide.
I think that's the biggest similarity is that being Jewish, unless you are a Orthodox Jew, or, you know, if you wear a yarmulke, like it's a hidden identity. You choose to express it. I've always been proudly Jewish. But it's always been my business and no one else's business. I started wearing a Star of David after October 7 because they made it part of a public issue.
Yeah.
And I had to come out. Mm-hmm. You know? And so, yeah, absolutely right.
I mean, I think the reality is the three of us are defiant. Right, your term of being a defiant Jew, and some of it, I think it sounds like for you, you were shocked and you were like, oh, it's because I'm Israeli and I didn't grow up around this. You know, our defiance, my defiance was my grandparents didn't survive just for some, you know, privileged college student to like justify my slaughter. There's no way I'm standing for that. But it's also a personality quality. Like I'm just a defiant person. Like I love rules and I hate rules. Right.
Like, but the point of I agree, but the goal, just like the brave gay men and lesbian women that came out first, they were defiant. They were the strong, but they created a society, at least in New York City, in the Western world, in Tel Aviv, in Israel, in the Middle East, where you don't have to be defiant, right? Mm-hmm. Like a kid's 15-year-old kid nowadays still has a lot of issues, but feel way easier coming out than a 15-year-old 30 years ago.
Definitely.
Yes.
And the goal is to do the same for not just for Jews, but for every identity.
Yeah. Yes.
Any identity.
Well, that's why we,
It's funny, like this, when we talk about like this emerging identity, emerging adulthood, sort of how fragile that period is. And this connects when I was 18, I was 19. I went abroad to Spain for a semester and I was the only Jewish person on my program. And we went out to dinner the night before Carnival with all of the Spanish tutores. They were called, they were basically hired to hang out with us and be friends. And there was one who was very, very popular and he went at the head of the table. Okay, everyone, we're going to do a toast for Carnival. He raised his glass and he said, okay, everybody, a matar los judíos, which translates to killing the Jews. And I stood at one end of the table and my sat there and my roommate knew I was Jewish. Nobody else did. And she looked at me just to see how I was going to react. And my face turned red. I was mortified and I sort of shrunk into my seat. And I didn't know what to do. And it sort of whispered around the table, oh, she's Jewish. And so I went outside to get some air and everybody came outside one by one and said, don't tell the program what he did, what he said. He didn't mean it. It's just something from the Inquisition that they said. He's a nice guy. He has nothing against Jews. And I felt so invalidated.
Which, by the way, may be true, all of that.
But I ended up calling a friend on a payphone that was Jewish in America to get sort of like to empathize. But I didn't say anything and I stayed quiet. And that was a moment that stuck with me where I said later years, I was ashamed that I said nothing, but I was young and I was intimidated and I was afraid. And I shrunk. And I said, I'm not ever going to do that again in my life if this ever happens. And I think that's part of the defiance, too. Right.
But by the way, for me, you know, infamously in 2017, there was the march where Jews will not replace us. And that led me to think of the replace the Jew test, which is whenever you say something and the word Jew, Israel, or Zionist shows up, just replace that with any other minority identity or country and see how that feels. Mm-hmm. You know, it, like, just think about standing up and saying, you know, deaf to New Yorkers. It doesn't have to be a you know, an oppressed group. Mm-hmm. Would you salute, you know, that? And if you, if the replace the Jew test, you know, if you fail it, then you shouldn't say what you wanted to say and mm-hmm. you should stand up for it. Yeah. I want to talk about so much more, but, you know, I don't want it to be my own therapy.
We're happy to do it.
I want to ask you, if there are therapists, Jewish and non-Jewish therapists, that want to join your network, and I should say, and you mentioned this, it's a safe network, meaning only you know who's in the network mm-hmm. and you match people. It's not out in the open, mm-hmm. which in itself is a problem that we can't be out in the open and say, you know, here's a network of Zionists and Zionist supporting therapists. But let's put that aside. How can people join the network?
From our website at GesherCampusCare.org. It's all one word. And there is a Join the Therapist Network tab. You just fill out the form and then you have the training and you're ready to go.
Mm-hmm. And once they're in the network, they potentially get matched with clients. So mm-hmm. how can students, faculty, staff, and now you're opening to the broader non-campus community, what's their experience? How can they join?
Same way. They just click the Find a Therapist tab. So, like, we try to make it very easy. You know, they can also always email us. I'm Jessica at GesherCampusCare.org. She's Shelley at GesherCampusCare.org. So if someone wants to shoot us an email, we really try to, like, connect personally with people if they need it.
And you mentioned the one thing that you're also, it's important for you and part of your organization, but financial burden is not an obstacle for therapy. So even if you're not sure if you can afford it, contact, you know, go on the website and, you know, and it's not the end of the conversation. It's the beginning of the conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. We are continually fundraising for that purpose. And the primary reason for our fundraising is, I mean, marketing is unconscionably expensive, but most of our funds go towards training and therapy subsidies. So the more money we have, the more accessible it will be for as many people as needed.
Do you have to be in the New York area for this?
No.
So the training is also virtual?
It's virtual,
it's
and we have
virtual.
Therapists yeah. around the country. We've had therapists from other countries try to join, but legally we are just sticking to the United States of America.
All right.
For now.
For now.
For now. And I, there's a part of me that wants to say, I hope you grow and grow and grow. And there's a part of me that says, I hope you disappear because there's no need for you.
Yeah.
So I don't know which one.
That's
I'm
our dream.
We say that every day. We're like, do people need us? Should we still do this?
Right.
So far, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. So we're going to end with the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series
yes.
of rapid-fire questions. You've done your homework.
We're avid listeners, so yes.
All right, so we're going to go very, you know, good. So we're going to start Shelley, then Jessica. Shelley, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Most people don't know that as a child, I primarily grew up with my brother and my male cousins who loved street hockey, and I was one of really the only girls in the mix. And so they would put pillows all over me and padding, and I was the goalie.
Oh, this is for a picture. Can you share a picture of our production and we'll put it on
screen? That's a really good question. I don't think the parents were like hanging out in the backyard, not interested in what we were doing. So I don't think there was a picture. That was
I
a long time
times.
Ago.
Yes.
Jessica, what is one thing people don't know about you?
It's funny. I have like a light thing and a heavy thing. And I'm like, which one should I share? I don't know. What do you think, Shelley? Okay. My light thing is, this is very funny because you're going to be shocked that you have two people on your podcast that are going to have had this experience. But I also went to a fat camp like Zach Sagebox. And it was actually one of the best experiences of my life. I loved it. I did not want to go when I was sent, but it ended up just being my happy place. So great for my self-esteem. And
wow.
And it was great. My parents pulled me out, didn't let me go back because they found out I kissed a boy.
Which is worse.
Yes, yes. So they weren't having any of that. So I got pulled out of it. But yes, so I don't know if Zach and I went to the same camp, but both had the same experience.
I love that. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That's what don't they know about the Jews? That we're all connected from a deep place inside of us. And they might never understand it, but it's true.
You can pass me on that one, and I'll take the next one. Because unless you want me to answer it, I will.
It's okay. What is your favorite curse, then?
Oh, that's a good one. So, two. One is the one my father used to say growing up. I don't say it, but I think it's so funny. He used to say Jesus H. Christ. And we would be like, what's Jesus's middle name? What does H stand for? I don't know why that was what he would say, but that was
Hebrew.
What he said. Yes, maybe. Yeah, so that's always struck me as funny. Like, Jesus H. Christ, Jessica, what did you spill on the floor? But yes, I'm an F-bomber in the car. I have a lot of car cursing issues. And my kids say, like, they're like, and then I'm like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. And they're like, just stop saying sorry, because you're going to say it again in 5 minutes. So
that's what I tell my 9-year-old boy. So, you know, stop saying sorry, you're just going to do that all the time.
So that's me with the F.
Shelly, how about you? Favorite curse?
I like all of them, but F-bombs are big in my house, and I don't apologize. My girls are used to it. There is, but it's the one I use the most. My favorite curse is a Hungarian curse that it's the only Hungarian I know besides hello, which is hogyvod. But lofos a segetbe, which is a mouthful because Hungarian is a mouthful. But it's like, go fuck a horse or something. Which I find to be like, who decided that?
We've never had that on the show.
I thought it might be a new one.
Definitely not the horse.
So funny.
When was the last time you cried?
Okay. Watching all of the hostages reunite with their families I watched every single one, and I cried through every single one. Especially the one with Ron Brusilovsky. Is that his? When he didn't recognize his brother, that was really heartbreaking.
I don't cry often, so it takes a lot. But it was at an October 7th memorial on October 5th, and I listened to the Israeli Shinshinim in Westchester talk about, you know, there were these 17, 18-year-old kids talking about the people they've lost and the kids they went to kindergarten with who died. And then they stood up there and were hopeful and resilient and strong. And I was it was such a mixture of sadness and gratitude and awe. And then I just got really angry afterwards that the world is not seeing how incredible. And American Jews are soft. At least it feels that way as an American Jew. Israelis are, to me, the most incredible people on the planet.
I think American Jews can afford to be soft.
Yeah.
They're not inherently soft. Mm-hmm. They need, and hopefully they'll never need, but they can become hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why we're doing this, so that our kids can continue to live in the luxury of softness.
If you could have any Jewish person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be? Let's have a Shabbat dinner together. So
yes.
Each one, choose one.
Are you going to choose one too?
I'll choose one. I'll match mine to your guess.
Queen Esther, because I want to know how she got all that courage when everyone was like, if you go to Ahasuerus and ask for him to save your people, like you're going to be killed. And she did it anyway. So how did she do it?
Yeah. My Hebrew name is Rivka, and I'm named for my grandfather's mother, who is Rivka, and my father never got to meet her because she died in the Holocaust. And so I was thinking about, like, my line, you know? And then it got me thinking to the OG Rivka, and I was like, she had to decide to choose one of her kids as the good one. Mm. And I was like, how do you do that? Like, how as a mother do you put a nation, a presumed future nation, in front of your own child? So I just, like, these women, you know, like these, there are so many, like Esther is another one, or, you know, but yeah,
and
we have
obviously Golda. I'm sure everybody says Golda.
Yeah.
Many people say Golda.
Yeah. So,
okay. So we got Esther and we've got Rivka. Who would I add to that mix? I mean, we have to stay biblical.
We don't have to. You could, like, decide to bring Amy Winehouse and say, let's rock it out. I don't know.
I probably want to invite one of the many, many, many women who are not named in the Bible.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, we know very few of them. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, even someone like, who married Cain? Like, who would marry Cain? And who, like...
That's so out, like, of the behind.
I love that.
Like, what? Let's, you know, and it would be a safe space. We can talk about it over Shabbat. Okay,
cool. So love it.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Hanukkah.
Me? So I have a love-hate relationship with Pesach. So my first instinct is to say that I love Pesach because of how it brings everybody together. But actually, in recent years, this is going to be a weird one, but Yom Kippur has become my favorite holiday.
What's your least favorite?
I mean, now Tisha B'Av, because this Tisha B'Av, I sat there, I watched the video that Aish put out. I don't know if you saw, they did a special video for Tisha B'Av. And I just had this feeling like, I feel like I've been in this day for 2 years. Mm. And it almost felt like redundant in a way. Like, I feel this way every day.
Yeah, I've never really observed Tisha B'Av, I've been to Israel a few times since October 7th, but the most recent one, I was on had an amazing guide who's an historian and doctoral level, whatever, and I was learning about Tisha B'Av and the repetition of the history around Tisha B'Av. And the destruction of both temples and the source, at least in certain, you know, explanations of the infighting within the Jewish people. And as we were approaching Tisha B'Av, we were seeing it in present day. And it was obviously part of what, you know, Hamas saw in Israel prior to October 7th. And so it hits in a different way, I think, sort of in a similar, But typically, if you asked my mother when I was a child, she would have said Pesach because I really love bread. And it was such a hard holiday for me to observe.
Mm-hmm. That's your love, hate. What gives you hope?
I can go if you want.
Sure.
You go first.
Yes.
So what gives me hope is that very soon after October 7th, I felt I had this image of the Lions of Judah awakening. And it was really like almost like a hallucination, like a visualization of this. And I would see these lions just like stirring and moving and roaring. And then I think of the lions and the lionesses, you and us and the kids who are wearing these giant Jewish stars who never would have cared before. And all of the, and my brother's work fighting, you know, using his specialty to fight, you know, again, in the legal space, and like all of these people who are proudly embodying our Judaism and in all of its different ways, and the allies who are stepping up, you know, you mentioned a few, but the everyday allies as well, that gives me hope. It touches me deeply.
Me, Jewish education, I would say, and I've seen this kind of playing out in my own life. I think I mentioned my father turned our family into a Baal Teshuva family, so I didn't have a Jewish education, but my children have had a formal Jewish education, and I was going in a direction away from Judaism before my father made this change, and my son is now in a gap year in Israel, the first in our line ever to learn in a yeshiva for a year. And my parents are there now visiting. And my father went to learn for a day with him. And my son, I said to my dad, what are you looking forward to when you go? And he said, just learning with Judah. And I said to my son, how was it? And he said, I think it was the happiest moment of Zadie's life.
Wow.
And
that,
it was...
That is hopeful.
Realized that the changes that my dad made, and they were hard when I was growing up, led to this moment where, like, my children are educated and they're going to educate their children, and we are going to continue on. And I, of course, have so much gratitude to the school they went to and their educators. And, you know, it's not a very financially rewarding job to be an educator. but it's so much work, and I have so much gratitude there. So yes.
So finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week? I'm going to say Gesher Campus Care. Gesher is Gesher Campus Care
.org.
So me, when I went on this trauma trip to Israel, there were two incredible organizations. It's hard to pick just one, but two that really are doing so much beautiful work. One is Metiv. They are doing trauma.
Can you spell that?
Metiv. They work they're next door to Herzog Hospital, and they help veterans transition back into their lives after the war, out of the trauma. For example, you know, you're in hyper arousal and guilt around what you saw, but then you have to go back to your family and be a fun dad and all of that. And then Peace of Mind, which is a really wonderful veterans program too, where they take units and give them therapy together. And then they bring them to all these different places in America, to communities. And they had one in mine, and the soldiers all stay with families, and the families take care of them and have barbecues for them, and they go into the schools and they have therapy during the day. And all of the soldiers that have, all of the veterans that have participated have all significantly reduced rates of PTSD and all end up really well in terms of their social emotional functioning with this program. So it's great.
So Metiv, M-E-T-I-V, and Peace of Mind. Shelley, how about you?
This is like so hard because I I'm the one who does the financials, so I'm I'm like really torn because there's so many amazing organizations and also we really need the money. So I'm going to say I'm going to push for GetShare because we really want to help as many people. We want to be able to support and subsidize as many therapy sessions as possible.
I respect that.
So I'm going to say that. Yeah. I love what Natal's doing and all of these. There's so many good organizations. It's really...
Yeah, Wider Bridge and JQY.
There's so many. And so many people doing incredible work, and we're just grateful to be in the space.
Yes, and thank you.
Where can people find you?
Instagram.
Yes.
At Gesher Campus Care is our handle.
So Gesher, again, is GESHER. That means bridge. Gesher Campus Care.
All one word. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, our website, GesherCampusCare.org. And where else can they find us?
By email. Those are sort of the ways.
And at your next rally.
Yes.
Or stickering around New York City.
With the Sticker Collective.
Yes.
Well, this has been an honor. And I really, really hope that, you know, you achieve all your goals. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Jessica Zmud. And I don't want to butcher your name.
You're good.
Shelley Steinwurzel.
You got it. Yay. It's beautiful. You're great.
Yes, here
we are.
We're
so honored to be here.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."